This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on May 13, 2016. We are talking to Nick Craver, who is a software developer, systems administrator at Stack Exchange, and recently very prolific blogger. Nick, it seems like, from reading your posts, it seems like you do quite a bit of stuff at Stack Exchange. Like, what all do you do?
Actually, we're working on job titles right now. I do software development and sysadmin. We call it site reliability engineer, which is maintains the external sites rather than the internal infrastructure. There's another team for that I'm not involved in. And then DBA. I'm the closest thing we have to one, but we don't spend a lot of time on it. We have a lot of developers that are DBAs, kind of a very depth of knowledge. So it's not a wide range, but I kind of hop around. Whatever's launching in 2 weeks to a month, then I'm on that kind of deal.
Why can't we call you DevOps? That's a pretty hot title these days.
Oh, no one knows what it means.
Right. Awesome.
I thought that was part of the point.
Yeah, exactly.
Get to just do whatever you want.
I'm doing DevOps. So recently you wrote you're still writing a long post series on kind of how you do things at Stack Overflow. So it's Stack Overflow, a technical deconstruction. And so far three posts, and I'll put the link, of course, to that in the show notes, but over at nickcraver.com. So I thought this was cool that you've got kind of a Trello board and people can suggest and vote for topics and things. So I thought I'd just kind of run through in the order that you've posted them, starting with architecture. So one thing that, I was wondering, so you're running Windows and CentOS, correct? Mm-hmm. So you always have to ask with Linux, is there a reason for that flavor?
It had a shiny logo when we picked it. No, we tried Ubuntu back in the day, but it's not ideally set up for network stack. It's more client tuned. We actually had routers back in years ago that routers and load balancers were on one machine. By the way, a very terrible idea. So since we've upgraded to CentOS, and it's just it's very close to RHEL. It's a variant of RHEL, so all the RPMs and packages work. You get a lot of support. So either you do Red Hat Enterprise Linux if you want a lot of packages and a lot of support, or something very close. And CentOS is the way we chose to go there.
Cool. All right. And then you've got basically all your kind of, routing, load balancing, all that kind of switching stuff, that's all running there. And then as well, kind of your stuff like caching and searching.
Yeah. So it's kind of, whatever is the best tool for the job we use at the time, and that's including maintenance overhead and management. You getting a new different tool is not cheap. There's overhead, human overhead, contract overhead, vendor overhead. So when we say the best tool, we really mean with all things combined, and including, is it worth moving, right? So for Linux, you're talking about Elasticsearch. We got Redis running on it, the load balancers, which are HAProxy for termination. There's a Logstash in front of Elasticsearch on some big beefy backend nodes. We've got various flavors of Redis internally too for different projects. I think I cover what some of those are in the architecture post.
So you're doing some interesting things with Redis. Of course, there's cache, and then you're using Protobuf for that?
Yeah, so we serialize in Protobuf. It's a library that Mark Gravel maintains. So everything we're sticking into Redis is L1, L2 for the most part. So in the web tier, this is something we really want to push down into the lib, that stackexchange.redis that everyone uses for Azure cache and all. It's the official one. And it'd be really nice if there was an L1, L2 API there, right? If I want to stick it in local cache, but also back it in L2 cache. And the same thing on the way through, it's write through, read through cache. And so it's not transparent. If it's not in L1, local HTTP member, it's not in L2, then we go get it. Could be database, could be API, could be wherever it's coming from. And then we have a wrapper library, which is technically open source. There was a RyuJIT bug a couple years ago, or last year rather, that we reproed from that lib. So the min repo up on my GitHub actually has it recreated there. And then there's PubSub as well. It's very, very useful in Redis. All of our WebSocket messages, you know, you just send when something changes, you just pop it in web in PubSub. All the WebSocket servers listen, and they broadcast it to all the clients. So Redis is tremendously useful. It only goes down when we upgrade it.
Okay. And then are there like frequent updates or anything you need to do that? I mean, it's basically you just kind of turn it on and then it runs, right?
Yeah, you just hit the install button and it's Puppet and everything inside. But yeah. It's been very rock solid. We're not on clustering. That's what a lot of people ask about. There's a couple reasons for that. A, there's no databases. You know, we have a lot of sites. So there's a database per site, both in SQL and in Redis. You know, the site ID is the Redis database ID. And that, you know, when you connect to Stack Overflow, it's one app, right? So if you hit stackoverflow.com on your web browser and you go to bicycles.stackexchange, which has like two questions a day, they're the same site. They're the same app pool. We can run the whole network in literally one application pool on one web server. And then it just uses the right database and Redis cache and everything on the back end. It's all multi-tenant. So a lot of our needs are kind of based around that. And that's one of the reasons we haven't ported those APIs and things like to the Redis L1L2, because not a lot of people run that config, right? You run your app. You don't run 50 copies of your app or for 50 customers. That seems to be rare.
Right, right. And it always seems that whenever you get into those kind of multi-tenant things, you're sort of on your own. Like, you know, like just about every web stack, and I run into this with ASP.NET, but it's in others too, where it's kind of like multi-tenant seems to be application layer, and it seems to be something that's usually pretty custom. Because I guess everyone has these kind of, well, our business handles our multiple tenants this way. They're all, you know, this must be different and this must be shared and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think what's shared, what's different is different for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at Stack Exchange, even from a UI standpoint, right, from a user hopping on the site, your top bar is the same, right? And that's in a common database and in a common Redis cache. And you're looking at your inbox up top, and that's across the network. And we have to do some aggregation for that. And again, we use Redis for a lot of back-end pipeline there, you know, queues and messaging. Even when you purge a key out of cache, it's using Redis to echo, right? And that stuff works pretty well for us, but yeah, it's highly specific. And that's the reason we don't open source some of that stuff, is because we could, but who's it helping?
Right, right. And then you mentioned WebSockets. So what all are you doing with WebSockets there?
WebSockets are a pain in the butt. We have a lot of connections at any given time with Stack Overflow. I think the fun stat that people like is there's WebSockets open to web pages we have for over a year and a half. When you have things like you get a question page and you see the score go up and down, or you see an inbox notification, all that stuff's WebSockets. So they're all optional. So that's how we treat them, right? They're not first-class citizens, but they're nice to have up. The problems come from we run on very few servers, which is good and in some ways impressive. In other ways, it's really annoying. In the case of, okay, we need to have all these WebSockets open to one location, which means one load balancer. So that creates a lot of issues where we have, I'm looking at a dashboard right now here, and it's 1.5 million open file descriptors for 500,000 WebSockets simultaneously. And that creates a lot of issues going through one Linux box. Because once your connection tables get big, it's actually, you know, there's a lot of kind of issues that you run into.
One other thing that was interesting with Redis is you've got machine learning with Providence.
Yes.
That is interesting to me. So I read through about, there's a separate post you linked to on Providence. And so it's a C# app, and it's going through and it's doing a lot of, it's caching a lot of stuff that is probably of interest to me as a user, right? So it's saying these are jobs you're interested in maybe and posts you'd like to see and stuff. But I didn't see much there. Like, is it using a machine learning library? Is it custom code? Like, what's the actual machine learning part going on?
We just pay a guy in the corner. We have a very, very smart data team. Some guys in New York, and well, actually, we're all over the place. But what they have is there's a couple of systems together that maybe I didn't make clear in there. There's a backend system that logs every HTTP request you get, like literally every single one. We don't log the bodies or anything, just some metadata about the request. The URI, what route you hit, how long it took, right? This is how we do some of our tuning. So how many times did it hit SQL? How long did it take to hit SQL? Redis, Elastic, all this stuff is logged. So at the end of the day, I can say, hey, we hit, we have 222 million web requests yesterday, right? And it did, 80 million SQL queries or whatever it was. that's the first system for data, right? So Providence can crawl and see what people are looking at, and so we can recommend better. It's purely for recommendations. And so Providence is doing the learning based on that. And this is algorithms the data team writes and tests, and we have a couple of beefy Redis servers that we can store all of that data in cache, because it's usually hundreds of gigs of cache in there for a particular day set. And then we'll have another, so there's three Redis boxes of 384 gig each, and it's, you know, all in memory.
Wow.
And when two of them, there's a master slave for redundancy, and then there's like a test box, which, and it varies which one's which, because when we upgrade or move to a new model, you know, we'll flip over and then reslave, and it's kind of transparent. And then at night, when the process runs, you don't want to lock production, right? That's always a problem at scale of, hey, how do you do updates without, you know, hosing people? Same thing with rolling builds or anything else, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll update the master and always pull from the slave and do preferential things like that. So the Providence algorithm is doing, seeing like what kind of tags you like, what kind of, where locations and everything. And you can go to Stack Overflow. We're very transparent about this. You can download all your Providence data. You can say, don't log me. Don't suggest anything. Don't record anything. And we respect all of that. So you can easily see like, what do we think about you as a div? What are we using to recommend you questions and jobs and things? And then there's the mobile feed, which is a consumer of Providence, the same way the job ads on the right are and some question things on the homepage are. So the mobile feed is constantly crawling the network, seeing what's hot, seeing what matches you, and pushing it in and out of your feed in Redis queues. And then as things, as you pull the feed with the mobile app, maybe eventually it'll get to the web. It's a really hard thing to scale, because even with the limited amount of mobile users, we're talking about 40,000 ops per second just all day long against Redis. And at night, it's just a quarter million a second for a while, you know?
Can I manipulate my my Providence data? Push it back in and like...
Yeah.
You just refresh all my tags into My Little Ponies?
If you visit those questions, you just make questions with My Little Pony and load them a lot.
So one question that I had also about the logging and the tracing, and I don't know when you'll get to this, because it's on your cello board. I think it says, like, talk about some of the crazy whack stuff we do. And I had mentioned this in a comment. I had said, how did you get to the point where you're trying to figure out, and I'm assuming when you're talking about L1 and L2 cache, you're talking about on the CPU, because you were talking about I/O bound, like, operations and trying to pull stuff through on the servers. And I'm trying to figure out, how did you figure out if it was loading like the L1 or L2 cache on the CPU, and you were saturating those buses?
Oh, okay. So when I talk about L1, L2 earlier, I mean HTTP cache on the web server and Redis in the background. There are other cases where, yes, that has mattered. There's actually a very cool project going on right now where we're rewriting our tag engine. So that when you go to Stack Overflow, and some other people have posts on this, and it's interesting because they black box kind of replicate it, and you're like, what do you think the tag engine does? And they say, well, you search for C#. And research for Java, right? And you get the questions. And this works on all the Stack Exchange sites, right? When you go to get that kind of stuff, that's the easy one. The bad ones are people, you can actually pass like SQL-star and C-star and load hundreds and hundreds of tags. And we want to give every permutation, and it's a big OR list, right? Across like 17 million questions, because the deleted ones are in there too. And then we need to sort them by whatever the sort is. And there's other restrictions, min question score. It does all of these things for which we outgrew SQL a long time ago. So the tag engine, every 2 minutes or so, it refreshes in the database all of the deltas. And we can do this, you know, we are very pragmatic. It's do the stupidest thing that works. We really are doing this. In SQL, we added a row version, which is a timestamp column, and it's just a sequence. Every time you update a row, it updates. So we just record the last time that happened, and we use it for two purposes. One, we update everything in Elasticsearch since that last happened, and the other is in Tag Engine. We do the same thing. We get all the questions since the last time we refreshed, and we do a delta in memory. When that was happening, it would actually fully saturate L3 cache on the CPU, so we'd see how much throughput's going from all performance monitors and everything. And we have a very, very, the Providence process I was talking about, the API to get that hit out of Redis has a very low tolerance. If it goes over 10 milliseconds, we actually post a chat and we send sound alarms. So that was our first indication something was happening. And it turns out that every time Stack Server would refresh, Providence would, you know, get the fuzzy end of the lollipop and just totally be hosed on performance for a little bit. So once we figured it out, we sat in Hangout, wrote some really bad affinity code, and turns out we're very bad at bit math, Jason Punyon and I. You can see some really nasty tweets. And the Provenance now sits on one processor, and Stack Server sits on the other one. We put them in their own little corner. So there's the two sockets do not run the same application anymore. We had to put it off by itself. And now, right now, Mark Gravel, there's some cool posts you can go see. He just put up about CUDA, and that's because we are porting the tag engine to GPUs. And I'm currently looking at hardware to order. We're going to get some 2U servers and stick some consumer-level GTX 1080s in them and use that to render Stack Overflow web pages.
Yeah, so I saw some of those posts about the tag engine. It's really interesting, and I think like there's a pretty heavy disclaimer in there about, like, you know, it's pretty hard to benchmark and all that, but it looked like some pretty big improvements on performance. And that this was on development, like consumer, you know, not super high-end GPUs, right?
No, this is Mark's running a GTX 980, not a Ti, which is a big performance boost locally for things like this. The main thing you're paying for in GPUs that we found is memory, like by far. So if you compare a $550 video card to a GTX 980 today, the new ones are coming out May 27th, the GTX 1080s. That's what we're gunning for to test next and use in production. The 980s versus like a Tesla M40. And this is, we actually had a test lab set up with machines from a company that we put four of these in a server, and we put four K40s and K80s. And we tested all of them. We've got numbers. I think we'll release all the benchmarks. So there's a rewrite of the tag engine code to be way more efficient. That's half of it. And then there's just a comparison of, okay, the same code, how does it compare on these GPUs? And so from a $500 card to a $5,000 card, it's only about a 40% improvement. And you're talking about the GTX 1080s coming out. They're a new generation of hardware. They're Pascal. They're 16 nanometer. They're insanely fast. NVIDIA makes some pretty big claims about them. So we're very anxious to see what kind of perf we get. But the main thing for us is they've got 8 gig of memory. So that's enough to fit our network tag engine on one card. So with two cards, we can do active-active and active-passive when we do updates and that kind of stuff. And it'll be faster than a $5,000 card is today for like $600. I mean, how much would you pay a developer to optimize that? And they'd still be limited by hardware.
Right. So I saw one comment on Hacker News where they're saying like that seemed like a bit that it could be a bitmap index. But I think what you were saying is that based on like there's some wild card searches and all that kind of stuff where a simple bitmap index doesn't seem like it would cover everything.
No. So there's a big question array, and then we have different indexes based on the sorts. And then past that, I mean, you think about a GPU is very, very good at multi parallel of high degrees, right? Can you run 2,000 of the same loop at once? And with tag engine, yeah, it works out pretty well. You just take 2,000 slices of the tag of whatever you're looking at and shove it through and then parallel sort at the end, and you take whatever page you want out of that. So it's actually like an ideal problem for GPU. So bitmap indexes, yeah, they fit some cases, but the more complicated, like don't do the ones that are closed, only do the ones with this score, sort by this or this and that. There's complicated stuff there. No, they kind of break down pretty quick.
Okay. And then one other thing on that is that Mark had mentioned he's got a follow-up post talking about how he's doing this with C#, and he's kind of doing C# and C code, and then he's got a manage CUDA reference. Do you know how he's got that set up?
Yeah, so the NVIDIA toolkit that you can use, by the way, it doesn't work on Visual Studio 2015, as I'm in updated, so it's really annoying. They're very behind the times. So when Visual Studio 15 rolls around, because that's not confusing, sometime they'll maybe support it in a year. What happens is there's for the parallel sort on the return, so when we want to take all the results that are in the GPU and bring them back, we only want to bring back like the first 1,000 after sorting them, or first 5,000, whatever it is. We don't want to bring back like 500,000 tags. There's a special instruction set we want to use for that, and the compiler that's built in the managed version doesn't do it. So that's where Mark went off on a little tirade for Bash on Windows and got the GNU version of it working. And so he builds a kernel and then brings it back. Hopefully the managed version just comes better. But you're basically just taking a C code and a kernel and throwing it, let it compile on the fly and throw it down. And you're compiling, you know, one time per application pool, which is nothing. but it's just kind of, it's a managed version that does that. Unfortunately, it's missing some of the newer CUDA stuff available, though.
Okay. All right, so we've got the tag server going. We've got a lot of caching. You've got search is handled by Elasticsearch, and I think you said in the post it's pretty vanilla Elasticsearch, right?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of stuff right now. I just built a new Elasticsearch pipeline for a 2.0 upgrade that we're going to do. Turns out that Elasticsearch doesn't have types. They say they have types. It's more of field groupings, which is a pretty nasty surprise when we wanted to upgrade to 2.0 locally. So we've got to reindex all of Stack Overflow. If you don't have your data outside of Stack, outside of Elastic, I'd imagine you're having a pretty bad time. But when that happens, we want to do some things for documentation coming up on Stack Overflow, right? There's kind of parent-child stuff. And the same thing on Stack Overflow, a lot of people find search confusing today, where you have a question and then you have answers, but they're both mixed together. And this is limitations of Elastic because a nested type cannot be the same type in an index. You can't have a post referencing a post like we have in the database on Stack. So we have to re-engineer how that works to actually get kind of nested search results and pretty that up. And that's just 4 weeks we haven't taken of dev time, of someone's time to fix up yet. So it's vanilla now, but we have big plans if we ever get the time.
Cool. All right. And then you've got SQL Server. So I know you kind of have a love-hate relationship with SQL Server, but it is powering, like you said, that's kind of the single source of truth on, like, for all your data, right? Still is SQL Server?
Mm-hmm. SQL Server and AGs.
Okay. So that's two clusters with always-on availability?
Cluster's the first half of the word. Yeah, with SQL, there's one cluster for Stack Overflow and that main sites database I talked about, and then everything else is on the secondary. And that's just for the Q&A sites and careers and all. Of course, we have other instances for back-end shenanigans. Not powering the sites, but, you know, monitoring tools and sysadmin type stuff.
Okay. And what version of SQL Server do you guys use?
Latest 2014. And I'm in talks with TAP right now. We're on the early bandwagon. I think we ran 2014 in CTP. We're a little late on the RC because we just haven't had time due to some big releases. But as soon as RTM hits for 2016, we should be on it, I would say, within a week of that happening in production. There's some really nice things we want. A lot of people want it for different big old reasons that Microsoft promotes. We usually want it for the smaller things. So Aaron Bertrand has a very nice article on this about performance of their string split that's added to SQL, and there's also a JSON parse, right? So today, one of the big pain points for a lot of apps doing a lot of data fetching is you want to pass a list of IDs in and get them back. So you have TVPs or table value parameters today, which are kind of slow relatively to most other things, or you just fetch in a loop or something. Or you put an in list of parameters, which works well, but only up to like 1,000 to 4,000, depending on the length of the names and things. So with JSON, you can just pass a parameter in and do a full in list based on that. And the split of it is insanely fast. It's way faster than passing a list of 4,000 parameters. It's a lot less data and a lot less stuff to do, too. You just serialize them and send them down.
Wow.
Very cool possibilities.
Yeah, man, it was a while ago, but I remember doing something like that with XML and using the XML parsing, and it's a pain in the neck, too. But it is important, like you're saying, to be able to pass in a big list.
How do you do that migration? Like, does that involve downtime to the site, or like when you're ready to go to 2016, or can you do it piecemeal?
Mostly online. The downtime in a SQL AG environment is the failover of the IP from one machine to another. And supposedly IPv6 does better at this, but there's a whole truckload of stuff with that. So what happens is you can upgrade the replicas, right? So we have one master and two replicas. One master in New York and a replica beside it on, you know, 20 gig of network between. And then, but there's not, unless there's a backlog, the bandwidth doesn't really matter. And then there's one out in Colorado. So in Colorado, we can test the upgrade even days ahead of time. So once you fail over to a newer replica, you can't fail back. You can only replicate to a newer thing, right? You can't absorb from a newer thing because the protocol does change every time or the database version changes. So we can upgrade the replicas, and then we fail over to the replica, and then we upgrade the master. And if we want to fail back, we can. We don't need to. All our machines are identical, so it's not like we're failing back to the master beefy guy or something. They're all the same. And what 2016 allows, there's some very cool stuff coming out AGEs, one of the big pain points for people is Windows clustering. We hate Windows clustering. There's not a – if there were a word much more strong, we would use it. it's terrible. And when you're spanning multiple data centers, it's even worse. You know, my dream is to put a server in Europe for Stack Overflow, a SQL AG, read-only replica, and we could serve all the read-only traffic out of Europe. That's the only way we get faster because we're fighting the speed of light at this point. So if we could do that, that currently means a Windows cluster spanning the globe. Few things would scare me more. But with Windows 20 or Server 2016, and especially SQL 2016, not at RTM, but maybe a couple months after, there's distributed AGs. So you have an AG per data center, and then a big AG on top of them that replicates. It's like a hub-spoke kind of model. So each Windows cluster is constrained to the data center. Even single nodes are in a cluster is an implementation detail right now. But that means we're on Windows 2012. Because to upgrade a Windows cluster, you have to upgrade all of them at once, right? There's no, every member has to be the same level, which is great because normally when you build a big Windows cluster, it's because you could take that giant thing offline. It's not important, right? That's probably why you bought Windows cluster. When you have an upgrade like this, what if we could take Colorado out of the cluster, build a new one, put a distributed AG on top to loop it in? Then we could fail over to it with Windows 2016 and SQL 2016, and then we could upgrade New York and be online the entire time.
Right.
That's appealing. So that we can actually finally upgrade our cluster by splitting the cluster and staying online at the same time without a crazy migration.
Does SQL Server on Linux like impact any of this?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about it.
All right. I'm just curious if in general, you know.
Not for us.
Okay.
If they keep screwing up the Windows per transistor pricing, then maybe.
Okay. How about, so Hackathon, or I guess they call it in-memory OLTP or something, but that was in SQL Server 2014. Do you guys use that?
Nope. We just put enough RAM in the box to put the memory's cheap. So we just fit the whole database in, or not, we don't fit the whole database anymore. Stack Overflow is outgrown that a long time ago, but enough of the good bits fit.
Okay. All right, and so that's really more useful if you need to be selective about which things are in memory. I guess
it's more of super high frequency access where you don't want to lock a lot, like you're doing high frequency trading or bidding or stuff like that, like an e-commerce site that's, or what are those stupid ones on TV you see where it's you bid and you can always win an iPad for 2 cents or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Then you'd use in memory, but I don't think they really care about accuracy anyway. So.
Cool. All right. So one other thing, talking about data, I got to ask. You mentioned that you've only got one stored procedure and you're working to get rid of that. And that
it's gone.
Oh, boy. So part of me, I get it from a dev perspective, but that partly, freaks me out. Like, for instance, I've worked in enterprises where we had really good DBAs and I would, you know, like there's some DBAs that are like, you know, the trolls that you have to submit forms to and they drive you crazy. But I've had really good DBAs like tune the heck out of queries that I had submitted and like things just got better over time. Whereas it seems like that's just a part of your code as well, right? If you need to tune it, you're just doing it in your code.
Yeah, we deploy code, you know, 5 to 10 times a day is one of the newer blog posts, and it's just that's normal. When you want to build out. It takes about 9 minutes or so from start to end, and tuning a query is very easy. And that it also takes, you know, when you're tuning a database, what if you need to change the results that come back? Well, now every deploy, you have to think about multiple cascading pieces, right? The maintenance is not free on a stored proc. So if I want to add some columns or remove some columns that, match this link model over here or just this raw query or whatever it is, now I have to be very conscious of what's backwards compatible across multiple deploys. Whereas if I just change the query and the app code that's consuming that query at the same time, all that's just gone away, right? It's much, much simpler. Stored procedures, a lot of people have this, I guess it's just old knowledge that it's optimized in some more efficient way, and it's not. Unless you're passing like a humongous query, in which case it's spanning many, many, many packets, there's no difference. You get query plan caching, we're very conscious of that because we're high traffic on these SQL servers.
Okay.
There's no wins. A layer of abstraction is not a win unless you're actually getting something out of it, and we're not. So we're paying the abstraction costs with no benefits.
All right. So how do you handle migrations? And you mentioned the thing of, you know, updating database and code and all that at a time. I thought that was really an interesting part of that post where you kind of go into that detail.
Mm-hmm. If it's a query, it's code. You just push the query, right? If it's actually a database migration of, you know, adding a column or changing a table, a lot of this is happening for the developer story on the back end right now. You would just push a file that has the SQL run in it as the next number, right? So we just, our lovely little bot in chat, very, very simple, I don't know, 10-line bot, we just post, take a number, push a file up in the next commit, and it will run everywhere automatically, except for one database. The site's database, when you think about Stack Overflow deployment, just like any large app, right? If you have multiple web servers, your database is changing at some instant, whether it be in the middle of the build, before the build, after the build, and then your app code's rolling out kind of slowly, comparatively, right, across 9 web servers, unless you're just taking an outage for a minute. Which not on the table for any large web app either, right? You have to cope with that. And there's one database, that site's database, that's global. You don't know which backwards compatibility is better, so we just don't make a decision. You run that manually as a developer. And those are really rare, maybe one a month or something.
Okay. And then you're using GitLab instead of GitHub. Can you talk about how that's working for you, like GitLab in general?
It works okay. There's some things that don't work at all. If you search a large repo, it just never comes back, right? It's just 500s every time. It hammers the disk like crazy. So, I mean, GitLab's good as a startup. Like, they're doing a pretty impressive little code stack. But at the same time, the performance, and we're testing GitHub Enterprise right now internally to test performance comparison. Because when we tested for GitLab, you know, we always check what's out there when we opt into anything, new software.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we have brains, I guess. When you the GitHub had blockers, it couldn't connect to LDAP correctly, which AD auth was one of the main, you know, things for us. Now that's all working fine. Setup's pretty quick, and it's fast. It's amazingly faster. I mean, it's not that surprising, right? There's a huge team that builds GitHub, and then another team that puts it in a box, and it's very efficient. They're using Elasticsearch, and it just works. GitLab. I don't know if this has changed recently. They wouldn't use Elastic because it's Java, and it's a whole stack they've got to include to get that working. They just wanted to use PostgreSearch, and it was just never really that good, if it would come back at all. So the perf is a huge thing, but there's other bits like, you know, when you want to merge a pull request and you want to squash it at the same time with the button in GitHub, you know, they put it to GitHub and it filters down to GitHub Enterprise and it's in there. GitLab, it's okay, I'm manually merging, I'm waiting on the file list. That adds up in dollars pretty quick, right, with a lot of devs.
All right, so then you've got a very interesting thing in here where you talk about translation. And translation is always interesting when you've got, like, the multiple different places where things need to be translated. What, first of all, I guess I didn't even really think that much about translation with Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange. How much of the site is localized?
All of it. If you visit as an office worker, all the programmeries is removed. No, if you go to JA, PT, and Brazil is Portuguese is the translation, and Spanish, I think that's all at the moment, and Russian are the four at the moment. So what we do is every string on the site that you see is translated. There's a lot of solutions out there to this, right? And they're not very appealing from a performance standpoint. So if you look at ResX, one of the things that happens is most solutions boil down to you take a string, you put the tokens in the string, whatever they are, right? And you pluralize based on whatever they are, right? So if it's one number, it's users. Or like if it's one, it's user. If it's zero or more, it's users, right? So you got to do that translation. There's different strings for each permutation kind of thing. And if there's commas or whatever, some cases get crazy. I sent out one of the stack code tweets had one of the crazier ones in there. People were like, nah, just assemble it. You can't do that because sometimes the list of users are up front in Japanese or crazy stuff, you know? But the most libraries boil down to put the things in the string and then pipe the string out. Well, that means you've allocated the string, right? And we can't afford to do that at scale and still maintain our allocation counts, you know? And because GC's, it's not free. So what happens is in the view, so if you have a translated string in the view, you say like @s_number, whatever, there's a special syntax to it, users. And you just put that there, and then you pass in the number of users as a object. You pass a model into this thing, just a very little anonymous thing, or an existing object, whatever it is. Then when we run something called Moonspeak, we use Roslyn to pre-compile the views and the C#. This works everywhere. And using statics is awesome in C# 6 because we can literally use underscore S everywhere. What happens is Roslyn takes that and breaks it down into what it actually needs to be. So when we replace the tokens, we're not forming the string again. We can response.write the pieces directly out to the buffer, right? So when you're going into the string, into this underscore S function, it gets replaced with a switch statement, or a call to a method, which is a switch statement, and the jitter will inline that, and you switch based on the localization ID, you know, if it's 1033 for English, right? And when it hits that switch statement, it will then response.write the strings for whatever that is. And other things we plug in are like, if that translation's missing, then we fire an alert, right? We know that someone tried to hit Russian and there was no translation for this. So we fire off to a chat room to alert somebody that that needs to go in immediately. But we need to be able to plug in some of this. And there's some things coming up in Roslyn, the generation thing I think I linked in that post.
Yeah.
Very interested to see if we could port Moonspeak to using that. And if we can, then that means we could make it available for everybody very easily. It's just something we hadn't had time to open source, but I think would be very useful.
Yeah, that was my next question, if it was open source, because this is something a lot of people hack together, but it does seem like, you know, some really good solid libraries that work for everybody would be great. And like, as you mentioned, like doing it very efficiently is important. So I had not actually realized, I hadn't gone to like ja.stackoverflow.com, but those are actually, that's not translating the site. That's like, as far as the questions and stuff,
mm-hmm.
I'm not, if somebody asks a question on ja.stackoverflow.com, that's not going to show up on the English stackoverflow.com. Is that correct?
Not unless we have a bug.
Okay.
Different database and everything for all the communities. I think I assumed when we put these up, people would be cross-posting to get rep in things, and I don't know. I went to look, and then I realized I can't read Japanese, so I don't know if that's happening or not.
Cool. All right. So, and then, you know, something that's near and dear to many people's heart is MS Build, especially this week. Okay, so you guys are using MS Build to handle the build process.
Reluctantly, yes.
How do you have that set up?
We're using MS Build because historically we have. When it comes down to it, we're just calling a compiler in some places, so we may get off that bandwagon. I think we're using MS Build mostly because it's what the tooling uses, right? You're pretty much locked to it by Visual Studio, which seems to be continuing as a trend. There's nothing special to it. I always see it as a trade-off when we set up these builds. So I do most of the builds on our side. Jeff Tagus and I set them up. And what happens is you pass like from whatever build system you have as variables to MS Build to a consume, right? Actually, I posted our build script, right? So the things up top are passed in by TeamCity. But TeamCity doesn't actually have a list of those. So if we did the PowerShell replacement, we have an equivalent PowerShell replacement file, just a tiny script that just takes a hash and does replacements based off whatever you feed in TeamCity. It would know about the variables and know that you need to fill these out, right? So it makes setting up a build easier. But at the same time, it ties you even further to TeamCity, right? And what's the best trade-off there? I don't really know, right? You don't want to make TeamCity be available to be able to build Stack Overflow. We never want to be in that position. At the same time, it would make life a little easier, too, until it didn't, right? But MS Build locally, we don't run it. We just build in the IDE, and we just run from IIS, typically. So it's purely just the build script that hits it. We could replace it, though. Depending on what they do with CSproj, we may or may not go down that route. I'm waiting to see. I mean, there's a lot of people that, with good intentions, trying to fix CSproj right now. I have really big doubts as to that it will be anything like project.json in terms of terseness, right, to get that functionality, because the main point was project.json didn't support a number of cases, right? So it fundamentally can't be that small. Unless there's a lot of defaults involved. I'm interested to see. I'm holding out and kind of standing aside and seeing what happens there.
But yeah, my first thing when hearing about it, like internally, I'm like, wait, what? Because I was the same. Like, I really like project.json, although I have seen it grow over time. Like, early project.json was like really simple, really terse. And then over time, as it started adding in these cases, you know, for other, you know, build targets and other things, and then all of a sudden it's growing and more complex. So it's basically like in ways re-implementing MS build.
Yeah.
Just in JSON.
So I don't know if you guys ever hit often when people add a file to CSproj, right? Now granted, mm-hmm. the wild card is going to fix this, but whenever you add a file in, you can – the Stack Overflow files, I don't know how big, and I say it's like 12,000 lines or something of files included. If I insert one and somebody – one of my coworkers inserts one, how does it arrive at the same spot? Right, and it's just kind of randomly right. in the file. It's not that I nested it under this. If you did, it doesn't work like that. So if you just put a file under in this particular spot, I just add one to the solution, and they do one in a completely different spot. It's like optimized for three-way merge generation, right?
Yeah. Although then, you know, then they've said, well, it always did support glob and folder, you know, like just adding
no,
in folders.
No, it didn't. They're full of, yeah, until you added a file again, and then it put them all back.
Well, no, what I'm saying is MS Build has had that support, but Visual Studio hasn't.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
So that's
Visual Studio that chokes on it.
Yeah, which is annoying. So then it's kind of like, wait, you've been putting me through this hell all this time, and you could have fixed it in one of these Visual Studio updates that comes out every 10 minutes, but...
And it, so Visual Studio, it also is like insanely low to reload a project, right? We have, mm-hmm. I'm not kidding, our developers have a script that does a git, it kills Visual Studio with a kill 9 type behavior, and then uh-huh. pulls, and then opens it again. Because that's faster than waiting for Visual Studio to say, a project has changed, do you want to reload?
Yeah, oh,
I believe it.
I don't know what it's doing. Like, I would love for Visual Studio to just keep a file, copy the file in memory, and look at the new file and say, this changed, do that. Pretend I clicked that action. Yeah. How hard can that be for, like, the top 10 actions of, like, add a file? It shocks me that this doesn't happen.
So let's talk about the future of like technologies that could happily or possibly fix things or possibly make things worse. Have you played with, first of all, Visual Studio 15, not to be confused with Visual Studio 2015, Visual Studio air quotes 15.
Yes, a little bit. First experience was downloading the web installer, which turns out doesn't support any of the stuff we use. Then going back to the full installer. So a little bit of confusion there. But my question is, I have no insider knowledge of this, but it's very interesting to me that what technologies they used in the installer, as if Visual Studio was prepping to support other platforms in general. I'm curious if that works out in the next 2 years. It's good, though. The current status is it's currently screwing up our solution file back and forth as some devs play with it and some devs do not.
Right.
Which reloads the whole solution.
Because it's some things that it is supposed to do is have support for folder-based opening of any, like you just pointed at a folder, you don't need a solution and all that. And then, I had the same experience. Like the quick installer is blazing quick, but they didn't have support for like web dev, which I kind of like.
Yeah, and it depends on your environment. Like we're not doing file new project that often, right? It's honestly, Visual Studio, I don't know if it's a loss of faith or I haven't really tried it in a while. Visual Studio, it's easier for us to copy a project and then like just trim it down and call it a new project than it is to go through any dialogues that I know of.
Huh.
That's our normal usage pattern. So if we have something, we're just like, this is close, and then we'll copy it and rename stuff, and that's typically way faster than getting anything from Visual Studio templates to work.
Wow. Yeah, that's always a tough thing, because it's like, okay, you want something out of the box that makes file new project to be like, to work, like that's important, but then again, that's not something that in professional develop, like once you're ramped up and you know what you're doing, that's not something you do all the time.
Well,
you don't do file new project.
I think it's a case that Microsoft doesn't really consider that well. I never hear this talked about, so I'm curious what your thoughts on it are. Visual Studio, they're saying, okay, what's common about the common web project? That's not really what's common to an organization, right? When we log errors, they go to one place. When we look at auth, we do it one way. When we do BOSIN and we do metrics out, we do it one way. So we have all this stuff set up for our infrastructure that is not common to anybody else. It's like a company template. And I've never heard talk about that or anything like that. It's like, okay, take this base project and make it the template. Or, that's not trivial to do at all. But that's more of the only thing we would possibly use, right? Because we want to see, okay, how do you set up, how do you connect to Redis? How do you connect to SQL? And we have libraries for all of this, and they're set up in a certain way, and it's just, frankly, quicker to copy and edit than to reset all those bits up, right? And I don't think Microsoft really optimizes for that case, but I don't know how rare it is either. It may just not be worth it at all.
I think that's so true. Every organization I've ever worked with in the last 10 years under .NET and Visual Studio, it's the same story.
You know, that is something I should check on. I know that you can export a project as a solution template.
Well, that Sidewaffle thing, right? Was it called Sidewaffle?
Yep.
I think had some of that capability, but when I last tried it, and admittedly it was a couple of years ago, there was still some wonkiness.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to check where it's at. I do know I have worked with Sidewaffle, and a lot of stuff in Visual Studio is like easy until it's not, you know? So like you get into this thing and then all of a sudden it's like, oh great, I have to do DTE, like anything with DTE, or I've got to like, so.
That was a huge appeal of project.json. Literally copy paste. Mm-hmm. I can new up a project in Visual Studio and just paste my config in. And I'm very close to getting there.
Is part of that that it solution and project files have like unique identifiers in them, whereas project JSON didn't. Is that something that would make it easier? Like if you could copy and paste a CS proj file?
Yeah, you know that silly GUID it adds when you in the, right. the X proj. Yeah, I don't understand that because it's got a relative path and that's unique. So what is it doing? I've never understood the need for that GUID, honestly. Yeah, that's a little bit of it. But I mean, you think about the project.json, there was so much about your config that's just easily to edit. And I hope CS Project gets slimmed down and you can edit it by hand. It's XML, but.
One of the things I started working on, 4 years ago? Was it really 4 years ago? My God. Was basically just a little CLI tool that would. It had some defaults set up, but it would basically just create a project structure and create a build.proj file that would just look at the source directory and take the wildcard of all that stuff in there. And but it was configurable through a JSON template. So the idea was that if I wanted to create I always want to use these NuGet packages or these libraries when I create a new project, or I want the file structure to be like this or the directory structure in a location, I could pass my own JSON like configuration file for the project. And I called it Project Starter, and I got like part of the way through apparently 4 or 5 years ago, and like I haven't done anything with it since. But it's the idea is that I just wanted something where I could new up a new project and just have it be CI compatible straight out of the box. It just had a build.proj file, so you could point MS build at it. You could build it all from the command line. Any kind of tool like Sublime Text or Vim or something like that, you could just point at the build.proj file and say, you know, build my project. And that's one of the big complaints I have with Visual Studio. And I've talked to some softies and other folks, and I understand they're trying to support their tooling, but I can't just, like, I can't write my own MS build file and have Visual Studio use that to build my project. Visual Studio still wants to have the CS proj and the solution and everything in the right spot so it knows how to build it. I can't just say, hey, use this to build my file. Then when you start the debugger, you'll have DLLs and PDBs and anything else you need. Just do that part. But I know there's a lot that goes in behind the scenes with IntelliSense and being able to, you know, add an interface in one project and have it show up in another without having to compile the project. And there's lots of that stuff. But I think that the simplicity of that kind of an approach, the project JSON, the MS build file, this little project starter thing I started, is, I think, better in the long run than the complexity of Visual Studio knowing everything about everything. That's kind of what I was, you know, hoping it would come about with it.
One thing I'm hoping is that, as you know, like ASP.NET on Mac with VS Code, like, has to work, right? So there's two different ways that could drive things in a good way, in which they say, wow, okay, in order to make that work, let's make .NET and ASP.NET like work in a configurable way that isn't so Visual Studio dependent. Or another way to do it would be like, oh great, we got to build all this stuff into VS Code, you know, and we got to make VS Code more like Visual Studio. And I sure hope it's the first way, in that It's like, hey, let's make it so it's not so, you know, Visual Studio dependent. Like that, I think that's a lot of what was nice about Project JSON and ASP.NET Core in general, is the kind of, it doesn't depend on Visual Studio tools to like paper over everything.
Yeah. And sometimes it just builds in memory, right? And you don't get that file in your Git commit because it built fine, but it never actually saved it.
That's always fun. Right.
And the CS Proj. The CS Proj isn't always safe, and you find out when the build server fails. I don't save everything before you build. This seems like a universally good idea, and it would be enforced by, you know.
There was a Visual Studio extension that Paul Betts wrote called Save All the Time. Mm-hmm. And it literally would just, anytime that something changed, it would save everything, save all. and that helped out a lot. But I think once he got kind of away from that world, he stopped supporting it, or it stopped working under Visual Studio.x.
Well, if you send Mads a feature request on Twitter, you'll get an extension in 30 minutes.
Exactly. That's true. Visual Studio extensions as a service. So how about ASP.NET Core, like just in general? Have you guys looked at, you know, like MVC 6 and, or sorry, I can't say that. It's ASP.NET Core MVC.
Yeah. RC 1 preview 5.
Right.
So we have, and I think it'll make its appearance in our internal tooling. So I maintain a project called OpServer for monitoring, you know, SQL and Elastic and Redis and all that stuff. It's open source on GitHub. One of the things that we need is Mini Profiler and some other bits internally, Stack Exchange Exceptional, that we log our stuff. These are two things that I mainly maintain. As soon as RC2 lands, we'll start porting those pretty heavily. Exceptional I have locally. I'm just waiting on a global exception handler, which has not landed in core yet. There's no like app domain on unhindered exception. There's no concept of that in core. But some of those bits... It's weird. We have to port these libs to get anything else on them, right? Those are those infrastructure pieces we use everywhere. We're watching performance with every app. So MVC 6, 1, whatever, it's a special pain point because it actually runs on multiple target frameworks, right? It runs on .NET 4.6, and it also runs on .NET Core. And they refactored it too, right? It's not just system like string is this over here and this over here, and it's the same thing on the same contract. It's actually a different API. Right, HTTP context, HTTP request, everything got rewritten from scratch. And it's good. It needed to be. But what happens is that when you make a lib and you just support both of them, then what do you do? And the only thing I've heard so far is that you can say, we're going to have the lib over here, and the suggestion is to put like .ASP.NET Core on the end of the lib for the .NET Core version. So now you have to maintain code bases with both versions, or share code, or fork the code. And some people, like Glimpse, they're actually taking a system.web object and converting it into a new one, which is too much allocation and overhead for us in a profiler. So we'll have to probably just, I don't know what we're going to do quite yet with Mini Profiler, because RC2 is still shifting a little, but supporting both the old and new ASP.NET with a lib for ASP.NET is going to be a huge pain point. That seems to be underestimated how painful that's going to be. From my point of view, from the ASP.NET team.
It does seem like that's part of why they got pushed back. Like, that's part of the Project JSON to CS Proj thing is trying to fix that. Like, I think those two things could be related.
I'm not sure if those are. There's definitely some other bits. I think Project JSON C# stuff seems to be everything but ASP.NET was not very well supported, right? Xamarin libs, other old libs, and that kind of thing. But I would think multi-targeting and stuff has to make a comeback. The problem is you can't multi-target. Like, do you share code or do you... Because Mini Profiler, like HTTP context, is everywhere. And it's going to be a nightmare. And I'm thinking at this point, yeah, I might just fork it and say we'll do minimal bug fixes on the old one because it's been very stable for a long time. And we'll release a new lib with rewritten code on the new... I don't know. It's been painful for every author, though.
Yeah, I was going to ask if Net Standard helps, but it doesn't in that case, right? Because the API has just changed so significantly.
That's the one case that's super painful. The other ones aren't bad. We put Mark Gravel did a ton of work on Dapper. I've helped on that one. Stack Exchange Redis is ported. The Microsoft guys chipped in, and we've iterated since then. And you know, we're doing .NET Core stuff for the open source because we don't want to block other people. We know there's hundreds of thousands of people using our libs, and we don't want to block them. So that's been our priority. Because Stack Overflow, we have things like .NET OpenAuth that do a lot of corner cases. No one implements OpenID correctly. Like, no one. There's all these quirks and edge cases, and those have been built in and upstreamed over the years. So, frankly, switching to the Microsoft versions of those libs or anybody's is kind of scary. Mm-hmm. We don't know. That's kind of blockers for us, is some libs that we are scared to replace or, you know, just aren't on the horizon at all. .NET OpenAuth is actually abandoned, so don't picture that getting ported, mm-hmm. right?
So you've been tweeting some stuff lately, some C-sharp haikus, C-sharp 6, and talking about some stuff that you're really liking. Anything jump to mind as stuff that is you know, you're most happy about or interested in? Like just new C-sharp features?
That null coalesce operator is pretty nice. Now, there's some things. I'm going through a lot of the Stack Overflow code base and refactoring it, and I was just like, wow, this is interesting, and started taking screenshots and tweeting them, because why not? Plus, it makes people really angry at us because we do X, and it's always fun. the ternaries, anything that makes a lot of code, terse is actually more readable to us, right? Like when someone tweeted the other day, like, this new version is not as readable, when you're going left to right, and we're like, the first thing that's not null, that's way easier to read to me. And it's going to vary per team. You should absolutely code or use tooling or whatever that works for you, right? This works very well for us. The C-sharp bits, obviously the Roslyn stuff, we really wish the out param made it in, right? Where you could declare out params inline. That didn't make mm-hmm. it for C-sharp 6. But it's mostly those kind of bits and Roslyn in general. That's what Moonspeak are. The translation service, all built on Roslyn, right? That's been a huge thing for us. That would be impossible 2 years ago.
Cool. All right, I got a few questions from Twitter. Matt Warren said, what performance issue have you had the most fun finding and fixing?
Ooh, most fun. The tag engine recently has been the most fun fixing. Some of the ones most fun finding, I think there was one back at Mix 2011. They did a Channel 9 broadcast or something on. I called Sam out. We're troubleshooting performance of output cache pages. And it turns out very subtle bug of, if you pass an int to a time span, do you know what overload that is off the top of your head?
Ticks?
Yeah, that's what it turned out to be. So it was not 30 seconds of cache.
30 ticks.
Yeah, so it was effectively no cache. And we turned it on. We're like, wow, we're going to see the average page time drop again. And it was always impressive. And it didn't. It didn't make a damn bit of difference. It turns out almost no one hits output cache in Stack Overflow. It's like 4%.
Wow.
But yeah, we find goofy stuff like that here and there. But Mini Profiler, that's huge. Everyone should get, and it doesn't have to be Mini Profiler, Glimpse, whatever. But the first thing you got to do is see there's a problem, and putting that big number in the corner of your page saying, hey, this is wrong.
Mm.
Yeah, this is so easy for all the devs. You don't have to be super experienced to say, that shouldn't take half a second, right?
Right, right.
I wish more people put that in. And that's hopefully the more we talk, the more people go, maybe I should try that, you know?
Yeah, especially like you're saying, just have a, you know, dev mode or dev switch. Like basically, hey, I'm in dev, always run profiling. Like, you know, mm-hmm. That's a great way to just identify those things.
And I don't know why people are afraid of overhead, usually is a big thing we hear. Mm-hmm. Let's put this in context. Stack Overflow runs it for every single request, all of them. And we store mm-hmm. the most expensive requests, and we spot check requests. A certain percentage, we roll the dice and record them. We look at them. We run it for every single request. If we can do it, you can do it.
All right. Another question from Matt Warren. What's the craziest thing you've done to get good performance? Do you have one weird trick? I put that in it.
IL normally. Which
yeah.
Typically, what we do, I think IL is the weirdest thing to a lot of people. C sharp's good, right? And you can learn other things in it. Where it breaks down is you're saying, okay, you take a set of parameters passed in, and actually one of the most recent ones we've done is tag engine or site settings, and you're taking a class and you want to call this method always under these conditions, right? But not under these conditions. Well, it's actually quicker to swap out the method you call that is optimized in a way that you don't do it again, right? So if, for example, if you're saying if anonymous users, yada, 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 or if one of the things I'm working on right now is the vary by param in output caching is actually kind of expensive. ASP.NET by default splits it and allocates a lot of strings in an array to then check against. And that's not an awesome way to go about it. So we do contain string, which kicked off a very cool performance golf session from Matt and Gank on GitHub. We'll probably absorb one of those back in. And if you take instead and you say this string always equates to this method, then you can just put out an IL the things about that string, right? You take the tokens we have and you can build the if checks you need to do to vary your cache breaker and do it once. And then you can output that, use that IL and just call that method. You're submitting a method real time, right? And it turns out we've just, this is a faster way to do things rather than doing if checks all over the place or elses or switches or whatever your logic paths are. So that's where we drop down to. We don't try to. Like I said, we're pragmatic. This is extreme perf conditions. That runs for every single request at the front of the pipe, right? So those are important. So what's the trick for Stack Overflow? Keep it simple. The more complicated it is, the more time you're spending debugging it, the more trouble it'll be later when you try to scale it. If you keep it dead simple for now, you can either re-engineer it easy or scale it easy. And usually it's the latter.
Cool. So I'm out of Twitter questions. I'm out of my questions. I've talked the whole time and have not let Kevin or Scott Allen get a word in. And Scott Kuhn had to go. Any other questions, thoughts, guys?
No, I think you used all the time, John. We just have to do it again.
Yeah. Kevin?
No, I don't think so.
All right, cool. Well, thanks a bunch, Nick. This has been a ton of fun. I mean, I could nerd out on this stuff all day. And I'm really enjoying your posts. I mean, it's cool how you're using Trello to guide the voting and stuff. And then I'm looking forward to reading more of them.
I'm curious how it works out. It's going to be a little interesting because it's by nature it gets less interesting as you go, right? If you go, but the tractions, the last one had more participation from people than anything with the deployment. So I have no idea what people were interested in. It's kind of cool to see it play out.
Yep. Cool. All right. Well, thanks a bunch for your time.
Thank you.
All right. We'll talk to you later on Herding Code.